Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to Brock's academic convener for Congress 2014, set to get underway this weekend. We check in with CFBU radio host and Brock instructor Marley Centaur on her participation in a conference on love and rock music in April, and we reflect on some of the many interviews we have been presenting here on the show. Bringing enlightened conversations to your day, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. It's a big weekend. Starting May 24th and running to May 30th, the largest academic gathering of its kind is coming to Brock, as the university will be hosting Congress 2014. This will be the first time Congress has been held at Brock since 1996, when the event then known as the Learneds came to campus. The annual Congress of the Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences brings together 70 learned societies and associations to share findings, refine ideas, and build partnerships that will help shape the Canada of tomorrow. In all, more than 7,000 attendees have already registered for Congress, and the event will literally take over the entire Brock campus for the last week of May. Brock's academic convener for Congress 2014 is Jane Kustas, who joined us in our CFBU-FM studios last week to talk about the event and the work that goes into planning for Congress 2014. I asked her first about her role in the planning process.
Well, Mike, I'd like to thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a real pleasure to be here and to have the opportunity to talk about Congress to the St. Catharines and a neighboring population community. My role as academic convener is to supervise, I suppose, or to manage the academic part of Congress. Congress is a meeting of meetings, if you like. Faculty members at Brock and across Canada and the U.S. are members of various learned associations, as we call them. So different societies, for example, the Canadian Historical Association or the Canadian Association for Translation Studies. And this is an opportunity for all of those various groups in the social sciences and humanities to get together once a year. So every society would be having its annual meeting, but the idea is that we would have the opportunity as well to meet other colleagues in different associations and, in fact, hope for some synergy and some sharing of ideas that way. So my role as convener is to manage, I suppose, and to promote the academic focus of Congress and also the cultural focus as well.
So it's basically a trade show of knowledge.
That's a very good way of putting it. Absolutely, yes.
Okay. How many people in all are involved at Brock in organizing this? It's not just you.
Oh, absolutely not. We're a huge team. There would be several hundred people involved because I'm working at this full-time this year. But many other people, for example, the colleagues in the communications, obviously the catering, the food services, all the AV people, physical plant, there's a huge deal of work to be done in terms of doing the setups for the rooms. These people would all be involved. It's not their full-time job. It's on top of their full-time job. So that's an additional challenge. But I would say there'd be very few people at Brock who would not be involved in this in some way or another.
And very few who are at Brock who would not be affected.
Oh, absolutely. Everybody will be affected by this, yes. And we're hoping in a very positive way.
Well, obviously. Yes, yes. But the logistics are such that I would imagine every inch of the Brock campus is going to be utilized for this.
Absolutely. We've had to convert lounge spaces into lecture spaces, that sort of thing, because we have over 8,000 people coming over this period of time. And so it's a challenge, in fact, to find space for these. And that goes back to your first question. Many departments, for example, are giving up spaces that they would normally have for meeting spaces, etc., because we do need the spaces for Congress.
Well, I think some people may wonder how much activity is actually going on at Brock at this time of the year anyway. I think the common misconception might be that the place is closed now for the season. I know it isn't, but I think some may interpret it, okay, the semester's done, they've all gone home.
That's right. We've put up the gone for the summer sign or the gone fishing sign. That's actually never the case. we have, for example, when we've had to close this down, we've had the English language program that runs this time of year, but we also have a whole spring session which runs this time of year. Mm-hmm. And we've had to suspend classes in the spring session for this week because we simply would not be able to spare the classroom space. But there are other programs too. There are all kinds of programs, for example, in the gym. There are the various camps, the sports camps, basketball, etc., which are not running this time of year for this 1 week because we simply could not spare the space. But they will, of course, pick up again once Congress is over. So we've suspended all of these other activities, which are ongoing activities, and only because, as I said, we cannot afford to give up the classroom space or the gym space.
Sure. So in other words, everything gets backed up a little
bit
to accommodate
it does.
This.
Exactly. Oh, okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. What kind of time frame were you working with here when you found out you were going to be hosting Congress 2014? The organizational time frame must have been considerable, I would think.
Oh, yes. We put the bid in, I believe it was 6 years ago.
Really?
Different universities bid for this, and we put the bid in. And I can't give you the exact dates, Mike, when it was accepted, but we have been working on this for really actively for the past 2 years. Again, thinking about it, once the bid was accepted, I was at the Congress last year in Victoria. I was at the Congress the year before at University of Waterloo and Wilfrid Laurier, just as an observer, trying to take some notes. So we have been working actively on this for over 2 years.
So this is like cities bidding on the Olympics.
Exactly. That's a comparison that's frequently used. And it's a very good one, too, because the idea of bidding on the Olympics is not just, obviously, that you have the athletes there, but the hope is that there will be a legacy factor, that there will be spinoff for the community during the time, etc. And this is part of Congress as well.
I would imagine there would be some universities that physically would not be able to host Congress because of the size. They may be too small, or the layout just wouldn't be conducive to being able to hold this.
Yes, and not just the universities, but the towns themselves.
True.
You have to have a huge capacity for hotels. You have to have a transit system, etc., enough restaurants. So when the bid is submitted, all of that is factored in. How many hotel rooms could be available? That sort of thing. So there are many small places, for example, Mount Allison University, which is a beautiful university, but in a very small place. So it would be very difficult for a university like that to host it. Quite impossible, I would think.
So when you put your bid in, they obviously look at Braga and say, look what they've done in the past.
Exactly.
Look what they've got now, which
yes.
is even better than what they had in
That's
the past.
That's right, exactly.
These people know what they're doing. They can host this.
Exactly. And also, as I said, they're looking, of course, at the numbers, the hotel rooms available, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. But also, and that was a huge part of our bid, of the attractiveness of going to the venue. We're hoping that this will turn into a sort of vacation opportunity for many of the colleagues. Mm-hmm. And we actually are seeing that when we look at the bookings of the residents. Typically, people will stay for 3 nights, but we're seeing people staying for longer, and we presume that that is because they do want to visit the area. So the appeal of coming to the Niagara area was also very much part of the bid.
Yeah, the fact that we have a great natural tourist destination here really plays well in you hosting the event because there's so much else that people can enjoy while they're here.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's, I think that's why the numbers are so high. What we can gather from the numbers, we don't have any hard way of knowing. So are you staying longer because of tourism? We don't ask those kind of questions, but we can yeah. look at typical patterns, and we're assuming that people are in fact staying longer because they do want to visit the area.
Yeah. And saying that, that has tremendous spin-off effects for the Niagara area because people are not all on campus and rooms thinking hard for 10 days. They're out there spending money, experiencing, and enjoying what we have to offer here. So the spin-off effects must be considerable for Niagara.
Oh, absolutely. And when I was in Victoria last year, I was staffing the Brock booth, so to speak, and we had already set up our website with the tourist information, pictures of the vineyards. Anyone who's interested can go on the Brock website and look under Congress, and what comes up right away are pictures of the Niagara area, the biking, the golfing, culinary experience, that sort of thing. And when I was at the booth, I would talk to people about coming to Congress, and that would be their first impression, if you like, and it was a good impression. Other things too, for example, the Shaw Festival, there are many things that people are aware of, and so they're sort of trying to combine that again with the Congress experience.
Yeah, I would think it would be an easy sell to get people
exactly,
going.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about 8,000 people coming.
At least,
yeah.
yes. But over the period, we don't have 8,000 at once,
yeah.
mercifully.
yeah, I don't think you could handle that.
No, we could not. Yeah. But yes, typically people, as I said, would stay for about 3 days. That would be the length normally of an association's meetings.
Do we have any comparison to past Congresses, for example, Victoria or Waterloo the year before that in terms of numbers?
I think we're going to set a new record. I honestly do. Victoria had close to 8,000. I believe that Kitchener-Waterloo, Wilfrid Laurier had, again, close to 8,000. But we expect far more. The registrations are already close to that, and we would get far more people who would register kind of at the last minute. This would be much easier to do in this area. It's difficult to show up at the last minute in a place like Victoria because that usually requires some prior planning. Yeah. So I'm sure that we're going to set a new record here. I'm quite confident.
So where do all these people come from? It's not just Ontario. Is it countrywide?
Countrywide and internationally. Part of our focus here was, in fact, to encourage the U.S. colleagues to come. So we have several events involving the U.S. colleagues, particularly from SUNY, the University at Buffalo. But we do have international scholars coming as guest speakers. We also have international scholars coming for the association meetings. So it certainly is nationwide, but it does go well beyond that.
So it is a big event.
It's a huge event.
Now, when people hear us talking about Congress, they're thinking, okay, there's a big event going up at Brock. Now, we touched on this early in the interview, but I think a lot of people in the community, other than knowing that this is going on at the end of May, don't really know what it's all about. So give me sort of like an encapsulated view of what Congress is all about. What's going to be going on there?
What's going to be going on for the attendees, if you like, the delegates, the registered participants, are the meetings of their associations. So they would be going to the meeting, for example, let's say Canadian Historical Association, and they would be hearing papers given by their colleagues about various topics. Our topic is Borders Without Boundaries, but the associations would go beyond that, the limits of that. We try to encourage the associations to try to work the theme, if you like, into their own meetings. So a typical attendee would be going to the meetings for their association and giving a learned paper and getting feedback on that. So this is part of our responsibility with respect to our scholarship. That is what is the purpose of Congress ultimately, is to encourage scholarship and the exchange of ideas. But above and beyond that, and particularly at Brock, because we work very hard on this, we have worked in a very interesting cultural program as well. And for example, there are concerts, there are two plays, there are debates involving the colleagues from the U.S., there is an event, Sipping Ontario Wine with the Stars. So we're trying to go beyond simply a paper attendance, if you like. That's what the colleagues would be coming for, to go for their meetings, to hear the papers, perhaps to give a paper and to exchange ideas. But we're trying to, again, encourage them to learn a little bit about the region and also to have a very good idea of what is happening at Brock in terms of the research that we're doing at Brock, including creative research in the arts. We're also encouraging, once again, the U.S. colleagues to come and trying to build some strong connections there. And we're trying as well to build connections with the community. So we're very, very much hoping that members from the community will come to Brock, will see what it's all about, get a sense of what's happening, but also attend the events. The Congress Plus program, as we call it, is free of charge for anyone. And we're very much hoping that the community will, in fact, come for these events.
Yeah, I was going to ask about community involvement.
Right.
That's not for the entire run of Congress, but a part of it at least.
Absolutely. If anyone wanted to attend the association meetings, they would be asked to register. That would be quite normal. But in addition to those, we have this Congress Plus program. Again, for everyone who's there, including obviously the delegates, we're hoping that many people will attend. But today I'd like particularly to reach out to the community and to encourage your listeners to come for these events, because we really would like to see them on campus. That's the best way to find out what it's all about. I can describe it, but I think once you're there, you get a much better sense of what's happening.
But could anyone in the community register for the entire thing, should they wish to?
Yes, absolutely. They would be asked to pay the Congress registration fees, and typically they would be, perhaps if they wanted to attend an association meetings, they might be asked to pay the association fees as well.
So it's doable, should they
absolutely,
wish to?
Absolutely, positively, and I would certainly encourage people to do that if they so desire.
All of these attendees, we're talking, as you say, about 8,000 attendees and counting, are they all staying on campus when their classroom days are done and they're going out into the community? Where are they ending up? Are they using all of the hotel rooms that you can find in Niagara?
The Canadian Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences does, in fact, the hotel bookings, again, long in advance. Many of the hotels are located in Niagara Falls, but they're local hotels as well, obviously. We have the rooms on campus. The residence rooms are fully subscribed. Mm-hmm. We would be expecting, because we're sort of in the GTA, we would be expecting people, some people will be simply drive down for the day and drive back.
Yeah.
That is quite common. This is what happened, for example, in Waterloo.
Yeah.
It was an easier kind of a drive. So we will be expecting people to be doing that as well, but the hotels have been reserved well ahead of time. The residence rooms, as I said, are pretty fully booked. So it's kind of a mix, and it's hard to determine exactly percentage-wise how many would be commuting, because those numbers we really don't have. We know how many hotel rooms are booked or how many residence rooms, but we don't know how many people are driving back and forth.
Yeah, but good luck getting a hotel room if you want
exactly.
one for your own use
exactly.
the last week of May.
That's right, exactly, yes.
And I think with Victoria, it would not have been as easy to commute.
Exactly.
You could do it, but not
That's
as
right.
easily.
But there would have been less of that kind of participation, yeah. this sort of the drive-in for the day, drive back. Yes, absolutely.
So this is a great way to show off Brock, even compared to 1996.
Yes.
So much has changed at Brock.
Yes.
And that's just great for you and for the community to show off all of the facilities that were not even there in 1996.
That's right. Yeah, it's a different generation is yeah. what we're saying, and it's absolutely the case in terms of the physical look of the place, obviously, but also in terms of what Brock has become and with respect to research, scholarship, including, as I said, creative research in the arts. There has been so much more development in that area, graduate studies. These are areas in which Brock has invested very heavily over the last number of years, and the results. The positive results show.
I would imagine the region, all of the cities involved, would have been probably on board in supporting you on this because they all know what it means to the region to have this happen here.
Absolutely. And again, going back to the bid, that's important. It's not just do you have enough residence rooms or do you have enough classroom space? They're really looking for support of the whole community, the whole region. In our case, we had support, for example, even from the University at Buffalo, the SUNY. This looks like a good idea, that sort of thing, because people are aware of the impact. Of the very positive impact. So yes, it was very important to have these people on board from the very beginning.
And with all of these people coming, transportation must be a monumental juggling act in itself. It's good that you've got partners, for example, like St. Catharines Transit
right.
and Niagara Airbus on tap to move these people
yes.
around. Because, I mean, parking is always at a premium at Brock to begin
yes,
with.
Yes, exactly.
You know.
The parking, as people know, is difficult no matter what. And once again, we're very grateful for our transit partners in this exercise because it's simply would not work without them. We do have a shuttle service. We're hoping that works. We're encouraging people to try to take public transit when they can because the parking is going to be difficult. And I think, for example, for the community, people might be used to having some difficulty finding parking, but this is going to be a whole new level of challenge. So I would really encourage people to try to carpool or to take public transit yeah. because they may find themselves somewhat frustrated as they hover around trying to find a spot.
So if people want information on Congress, the Friday night is the opening reception.
That's right.
And then things get underway.
Mm-hmm.
If people want more information, where do they go?
Well, I would start with the Brock website, the Congress 2014. If you go to the Brock website, there is a link there. You can look up the events and that sort of thing. There would be phone numbers as well if people want information. So that would be where to start.
For you yourself, mm-hmm. you've been working on this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
When you're done,
yes.
How soon before you get a vacation?
Oh, not too long. Not too long, not too long. I'll be taking some time this summer, I can promise you, yes.
And doing very little, I suspect.
I'm going to try to do very little. That's not easy for me, but I'm going to really focus on trying to relax.
It's the thought that counts.
It's absolutely, yes.
Jane, thank you very much for coming in. Best of luck. It sounds like an exciting event, and I think the community at large should be on board and support you because this is going to be a big event. It's a prestigious event to come to Niagara.
Absolutely. So thank you once again for giving me the opportunity to talk about this, and I really do want to extend a very, very warm welcome to all of your listeners. Please do join us at Congress. Come to see what it's all about. Take part in some of the events. We really look forward to having you on campus.
That was Jane Kostas, academic convener for Congress 2014, which kicks off this weekend. The opening reception is on the weekend at Rodman Hall. Last January, we heard from Brock instructor and CFBU-FM radio host Marley Sintawar about her extensive research on the Beatles and other aspects of rock music that form part of the courses she teaches at Brock. At the time, she mentioned she would be attending a conference on love and rock music in France in April, and you have to admit that's somewhat more interesting than some conferences you can attend. So I invited Marley to return to the studio upon her return from France to talk about the conference and her adventures, which included paying homage to Jim Morrison at the Doors and traveling later to Timmins, Ontario, for some specialized teaching opportunities when she returned from France. We began by talking about the conference and her participation in it, and how she's already been spending her summer vacation.
Sure, yeah. So my summer vacation started a bit early. I was gone for most of the month of April once classes finished at Brock. I was accepted to present a paper at a conference in the south of France in a town or city called Montpellier, and I presented at a conference that was dedicated to love and rock music. I think it was in French, Le Rock and L'Amour, and it was an international conference put on by two universities, but it was held at the University of Paul 12 Valerie, which is just downtown Montpellier. And I think the conference was about 40 or 50 people, and all the papers submitted were to be focusing on representations of love in rock music. So there were a lot of different panels. My particular panel was called Love Me Tender, after the Elvis song, and the papers in the panel were a bit varied. My paper looked at the representation of love in lyrics from the singer-songwriter Liz Phair. So we talked a little bit about that.
Yes, we did.
The last time I was here, I just touched on it a little bit. But the paper looked at recordings that Liz Phair did in the early 90s, and she recorded a series of songs in her childhood bedroom home after she graduated from college. She graduated with a fine arts degree from Oberlin College. So she was kind of out of work and didn't have any money, so she had to move home at 23, and she found herself in her childhood bedroom, and she was writing these songs that were really provocative, and in terms of lyrics and how she was talking about love and modern relationships. So it was really interesting, these songs that she was coming up with that incorporated really provocative, challenging lyrics, but also were kind of childlike and innocent in the same ways. She was using a lot of chords that were very similar to nursery rhymes and jump rope rhymes. So you had this weird juxtaposition of like love, relationships, and then this like childhood innocence as well. But what I found in my paper when I was putting it together and researching it was her style of music was very lo-fi indie. It was just a guitar, herself singing, and recorded using four-track technology. So this is before GarageBand or digital means to make music.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what era are we talking about?
Yeah,
here?
The early 90s.
Okay,
so
yeah,
1991.
Yeah, because now you could easily put a nice little studio in your bedroom and record with no problem at all.
Yeah.
It would have been different even in the 90s from now.
Very, very different. So I was really fascinated with that. And then it's also interesting because she was based in the Chicago area when she was making these tapes. But from my research and knowledge of the cultural history of the time with youth culture, it's interesting that her work really reflects a lot of work that was coming from the West Coast with young women called Riot Girl. It was a subculture, a movement connected to music, but also art and do-it-yourself media production. So I thought that was really interesting how she almost had this kind of diffused Riot Girl aesthetic with her music style and sound. And it was a really interesting paper to write because I've loved those recordings for so long from a very young age. I think I was 14. They're bootlegs, so which means that they were dubbed copies of the original master tapes that Liz Phair made. And she gave them to two of her friends who circulated them through the underground indie scene in the 90s. And then the tapes, there were about 30 songs in total, were in different forms. There were different titles, different track listings. But some of the songs ended up helping her get her recording contract with Matador Records. And then her first album, Exile in Guyville, came out in 1993 to pretty wide critical acclaim for one of the strongest albums of the 90s, and also for a woman of rock, I guess you could say, for Liz Phair. And she was very much challenging the masculine-dominated world of rock. And the album Exile in Guyville is positioned as a track-by-track response to the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street, the album from 1972. But she also reworked songs from these girly sound recordings, which is the recordings that I talked about in my paper, and puts them on some of her studio albums.
I'm curious, when you write a paper, how long does it take you to prepare a paper for a presentation like this?
That's a great question. And for this particular paper, I mentioned that for years I've loved these recordings. I've had all this, to quote Dylan, useless and pointless knowledge stored in my head about it. So it was just waiting to be written. And I'll be honest, I actually didn't write the paper until about 3 days before I presented.
Really?
I had information compiled, and it was just all the thoughts were swirling around in my brain. And I ended up flying to Switzerland first to stay with family as my home base, and then took the train down to Montpellier. So in the in-between time between arriving in Europe and then the conference, I wrote the paper and edited it. But if I had had more time, I definitely would have written it sooner. It was a time issue with end of term school and writing the paper.
That's a daring move, you know.
Very daring.
You leave Canada, fly to France to present a paper that you haven't even written yet. Now that takes chutzpah.
Yeah, that's a bit... Thank you. So it went well. I was very fortunate that I was able to produce the paper and the PowerPoint that I used. And
But again, coming back to technology...
Yeah.
You can do that now because you can take a tablet computer with you, for example, and you can write.
Right.
Or something else. But in the old days, you'd be lugging around an old manual Underwood typewriter like I used to do.
Right. So, yeah, even our little conversation here about technology, how it's changed so quickly.
So you were at the conference.
Mm-hmm.
How long was the conference?
Conference was 2 days.
Okay.
And it was 2 days long, so pretty full days. Unfortunately, I got sick for part of the conference. I got sick again for a third time this term, which was unfortunate, but I think it was from traveling and jet lag. So I had a viral infection, and fortunately, I was able to make myself well for my presentation, but I wasn't able to go to some of the first day, which was unfortunate because it was such a great conference. There were really interesting panels and papers on everything from rock biographies, so looking at how love is discussed in terms of a musician's life, how they write their life story. There were papers on nostalgia in indie folk music, looking at love for certain places and how that's expressed in song, and then even papers on groupie culture. So fan responses to love or expressing love and adoration for music in that particular way.
So a two-day conference, it might have taken you longer than that to put your thoughts on paper than the conference itself.
Right. So it's a 20-minute paper presentation.
When you're there, you're giving your paper.
Mm-hmm.
Do you gauge the audience reaction to it? You've got all these people sitting there listening to you, but are you sort of like a performer on stage trying to read the audience, see if they're with you on this or not?
It's interesting. I think more in a teaching situation, say in a classroom setting, teaching a class, you do gauge the audience in a different way than you would at a conference, at least in my experience. For a conference, there's different approaches. Some people are more informal, or some people do prepare a script, and I prepare my papers if it's an essay, and there will be areas where I'll elaborate more informally, but just using that approach, it's not so much about gauging the audience, it's just trying to deliver the information in an engaging, interesting way. And I was fortunate, I had a great reception to my paper, and people seemed genuinely interested in the topic, which is really all I could ask for, because sharing just my passion for the topic was so fun to do at the conference.
And you couldn't do it if you didn't have that passion.
Right.
Right.
Passion is key.
Do you take questions from the audience when you do something like this?
Yeah, so the way that this conference was set up was different than other conferences I've presented at in the past. My panel had three presenters. I was in the middle. So each presenter was given 20 minutes, and they were very adamant about just 20 minutes, so no time creep over that. So 20 minutes presenting, and then 10 minutes at the end of each paper for questions from the audience. Other conferences I've been to in the past, they will have the three presenters present one after the other, and then have about a half an hour at the end for questions. But it was nicer that they did it this way, so each paper had more specific questions right afterwards. It was more of a focused discussion.
So the people who would be watching the presentations, the audience in other words, what's the makeup of the audience? Who are these people?
So that's a good question. For this conference, it was mostly presenters who were attending the conference. So it was about 40 people from all over, all different disciplines, from professors to graduate students, PhD candidates, with different backgrounds. The beauty of popular music studies is it's very interdisciplinary. There's not one particular branch of pop music studies that you can do per se, but people come to it from all different backgrounds, from cultural studies to English to history, you name it. There's all different approaches. So people are from all different academic backgrounds.
So love and rock music loving, basically.
There you go.
Basically what it was.
Yeah.
So the conference was 2 days, mm-hmm. and this was in Montpellier.
Mm-hmm.
How long did you spend in France? Total.
Well, that's a great question. So I was in France for the conference for 4 nights, so about 4.5 days. So I was able to do some exploring in the city. It's quite an old city. It's a beautiful experience to see. And I was able to go to a retrospective exhibition of Linda McCartney's photographs.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a nice rock and roll connection there as well.
Sure.
Which was really fascinating for me because I, being a big Beatles fan, first and foremost, but also interested in photography. So it was really nice to learn more about her life and work. I have some of her books and I was familiar with her photography from my Beatles research, but to see an actual exhibition of 200 photographs of her work really positioned her as an important photographer in the history of not only rock and roll, but also the medium as well. So it was beautiful. It wasn't just rock and roll photographs. It was really intimate photographs she did of her family, Paul McCartney, Friends. And then the exhibit also talked about the way that she played with different aspects of the medium, so kind of evoking older photography traditions and photographers. It's really fascinating. They even had an interesting video. I guess they made it in the early 90s, her and Paul. They put her photographs of the Grateful Dead set to music, and it was playing along with a documentary about Linda's work, so you could learn a bit more about her background in life. So for those of you people who don't know about Linda McCartney, before she met Paul McCartney, she was working as a photographer for the Fillmore East, which was a kind of the sister concert hall to the Fillmore West, which was in San Francisco. And the Fillmore East was in New York City. So these were really key establishments to house this music that was coming up in the 60s that was so challenging and so new and so radical. So she photographed all kinds of people at the Fillmore East. And it was interesting, too, because there were a few self-portraits or portraits of Linda McCartney. And one of them really struck my attention. And then I read and it said Linda McCartney as photographed by Jim Morrison. I was like, wow, that's interesting. What happened there? How did they know each other? And they met each other at the Fillmore East. And it's been rumored they had a relationship. But that was interesting to see. He actually took a few photographs of her that were in the exhibit.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was wonderful. So I was in France in Montpellier for that week. And then I was staying with my uncle Reno, who lives in Basel in Switzerland, and then I recuperated from feeling sick. And anyways, we just kind of decided to take this impromptu trip to Paris. And there's a Jim Morrison connection here too, and rock and roll, because we wanted to go, it might sound a little morbid, but if you're a pop music fan, you might be interested in this. We wanted to go to Père Lachaise, which is the big cemetery in Paris, because Jim Morrison is buried there. So we did. We did this trip where we just went to Paris for one night. We took the fast train from Basel and we went to Paris. That was our first stop when we got to Paris, apart from getting something to eat. And a little funny story, we got separated on the subway, but because we knew that we were meeting at Père Lachaise, we met like an hour apart from one another at Jim Morrison's grave. So my uncle was sitting there, and we don't have cell phones, of course.
Right.
So we had no way of contacting each other, but we knew that we would meet at Jim Morrison's grave in Père Lachaise, and we did. And it's a fascinating rock and roll landmark.
Absolutely.
It's the most visited grave in Père Lachaise, which is amazing considering so many notable figures are there. Oscar Wilde, Edith Piaf. I think those are the top three, but also everyone from Georges Méliès, who's an early silent film director, to Marcel Proust, to all kinds of Modigliani's there, all kinds of notable artists and writers.
But it doesn't surprise me because more people in this day and age are familiar with Jim Morrison than some of the others who would be there.
Mm-hmm. So the two graves that I encountered that were the most popular, Oscar Wilde and Jim Morrison. And when you get to Jim Morrison's grave, it's blocked off with a barricade. You can't actually go up to the grave.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. And there were a lot of people around that grave and also Oscar Wilde's, which is actually half enclosed in glass because so many people would kiss the tombstone and leave lipstick marks. And I was learning, just from researching the Jim Morrison aspect of Père Lachaise, I guess they have changed the tombstone over the years. I think the original got damaged. And the original said Jim Morrison, but the new one was put in by his family, who he actually wasn't really in contact with during the latter part of his life. But they changed the tombstone to have a phrase in Latin that says James Douglas Morrison, so his full name. And then in Latin it says, and this is what my uncle told me is the translation, it might be different, but he followed his own demons or demon, something like that. He followed his own path or something.
Interesting.
To that extent. Yeah. And there was also a very iconic, famous bust of Jim Morrison that was part of the grave years ago, but that was demolished by fans. And there was so much graffiti in the early days of his grave being there. Now it's barricaded. There's no graffiti. They've cleaned it up because all the other tombstones and things were getting damaged around.
They mean well, but they're doing more damage than anything else.
Yeah. I mean, when you do these kind of things, and you see these places, it's fun, it's interesting, but you have to remember, like, it is somebody's life, and it's somebody laid to rest, and it's kind of sad in a way. There were a lot of, like, fake plastic flowers, and I don't know, it just seemed a bit cheesy, and I don't know, I felt the same way when I was in Liverpool, and certain kind of tributes to the Beatles, I just felt it wasn't enough of a memorialization of the beauty of the work, or the beauty of the life of, say, the work of Jim Morrison, so that was a bit unsettling. We also were able to visit the apartment building where he passed away, so the famous famous story about Jim Morrison passing away is he died in the bathtub. So it was interesting to see exactly where that building was. It's quite a wealthy, affluent area of Paris. And to get a sense of his life when he lived there. I think he was there for maybe 6 months. I have to check the dates. After the Doors finished LA Woman, he went to Paris, wanted to work on his poetry. He lived with his girlfriend, Pamela Corson, and he was there for a while and then passed away in the bathtub under mysterious circumstances. Some say it's a heart attack. Some say it was heroin overdose. They never did an autopsy on Jim Morrison, so nobody knows. Even people say that's not him buried in the cemetery, but...
We'll never know.
We'll never know, but it was interesting for me to see that other people were seeking out these places as well, so there's a larger interest in these sites, apart from pop music geeks like myself, or nerds, or whatever. Scholars.
Scholars, I think, is a better term.
Scholars. Yeah. So I met these girls from Germany who were there. They drove down specially from Germany just to go see the grave and the apartment building. Mm. And we actually went in the foyer to see what the building was like, but then they asked us to leave because it's private property and I'm sure they get a lot of people there. Yeah. But apparently it's the apartment where he was on the third level. So I was able to take some pictures and just get a sense of, you know, he would have walked those streets and his life. And that was a highlight for me for the trip. And also what I said earlier, the Linda McCartney and the conference as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you spend most of April, Basel, Switzerland, Montpellier and Paris in France. Then you come back and you fly to Timmins.
Yeah, my life. Such extremes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So why were you in Timmins?
Well, Timmins is an interesting story. So at Brock, years ago, I took the program at Brock first. So it was a center at Brock, the Center for Teaching, Learning, Educational Technologies. That's what it was called at the time, CTLET. Now it's called the Center for Pedagogical Innovation. So it's a center at Brock that's dedicated to helping teaching assistants, instructors, work on their professional development, whether that be lesson planning or working on strategies for teaching classes. It's a center that's there to provide this kind of help for instructors, graduate students, and faculty as well. So Brock runs a program called the ISW, or the Instructional Skills Workshop, and it's a over 30-year-old program that started out west, and it's a 3-day, 24-hour instructional skills workshop, and it helps faculty or teaching assistants with their professional development with teaching, and it's structured around teaching mini lessons in small groups, and then also talking about teaching and learning questions or strategies in a larger group setting. So it's set over 3 days. It's about 8 hours each day, and participants are guided by facilitators through this structure and teaching with a mini lesson structure that's called BOPS. So it's a mini lesson plan, and then they're teaching to people in their small groups, and there's a whole structure to it that's really fascinating. So I did the program as a graduate student, and then I was so fascinated with the experiential learning aspect of the ISW that I inquired, and they were actually looking to train facilitators for Brock. And facilitators can be faculty, staff, so people who are interested can train to be a facilitator depending on the need at certain institutions. So I trained to be a facilitator, and since 2008 I've done a number of ISWs at Brock, and this opportunity came up in Timmins. They were looking for facilitators for Northern College, and through my connection with Brock I was able to help with the workshop in Timmins with two wonderful facilitators that I just met at the Timmins airport. We had talked through email, but they were just wonderful. So it was a really great experience and a nice transition back to Canada after being away in Europe.
So you've done that. You've done Timmins. You're back in St. Catharines now. You've got your show back on CFPU.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to do with the rest of your summer?
Well, thank you. That's a good question. So I do teach yoga in the area. So I am teaching a number of classes in St. Catharines, but also in Niagara-on-the-Lake. So if anybody's interested, you can check out the yoga schedule. I have a blog called barefootandfrolicking.com. There's a little tab that says yoga. If you want to come check out a yoga class, there's a few to choose from. Other than that, I am scheduled to teach two classes at Brock for the summer term. So the first is a first-year visual arts-based class called Intro to Visual Culture. So I taught that last summer, and it's a wonderful class. It's an introduction to the key concepts looking at images in our contemporary culture or through the 20th century. So we talk about everything from the importance of photography to film, mediated images, everything from images in popular culture. So a lot of my focus in that course is on even images associated with rock and roll, the 60s, also activism, social activism, visual arts. We talk about everything. It's such a fun course and students love it, and it's a really great time. And the other course is a new offering at Brock. It's from the Center for Studies in Arts and Culture, and it's the course I taught last semester. It's called Media Transformations in the creative arts. So it's third year, third level class. And it's really great that they're offering it in the summer term. It's such a fun course to take for a 6-week period. And it's a course that looks at the ways in which different artists and individuals have used media throughout the 20th century. And I kind of frame the course like looking at the advent of modern photography. And we look at how different media or mediums are used to convey creative or artistic expression. So it's a special topics course in a sense. So each week is dedicated to a particular focus or topic. And certain lectures, I've done everything from, we do a lecture on social activism. So the ways in which activists use different media, especially now with social media, it's really interesting to see how activism or activist groups like Greenpeace use social media as a tool for countercultural expression or connecting exactly. with people. Yeah. And we watch a great film called Greenpeace Making a Stand, which focuses on the work of Rex Weiler, who's a co-founder of Greenpeace International, and gives a nice history of Greenpeace and how they use different concepts with the media to get their message across. And I've also done classes on the history of music recording technologies. We look at music videos, talk about the Beatles and how they changed the face of rock and roll, and even new groups such as Radiohead and how they kind of explore the mediums of music videos. They produced a whole series of anti-music videos for their album Kid A in 2000, and it's a great article about Radiohead that's part of the course package. So such a fun course. Student response is great, and I encourage anybody looking to pick up a summer course, if you want to take an elective or if it's your focus, to join us for STAC 3PO1. So it's also cross-listed with Interactive Arts and Science, and I believe Visual Arts as well.
You just never stop, do
no,
you?
No, I don't.
Yeah. Well, here's your last question.
Sure.
I know you as a writer, a photographer, commentator, instructor, rock aficionado, Beatles fan, radio host, and health food guru.
Thank you.
Taking all that into consideration, what have you not done with your life that you think someday I would like to do what?
Well, my unsung dream, and that's a pun, is I would love to play music. Like, I play guitar. I'd love to have or be in a position to play for people or to work on having a more of a musician mind. So I always struggle with that because I love music and I would love to be able to write songs and perform in a band and with other people. But I don't know. I tend to get caught up in the academic approach to rock, like studying the artist rather than being the artist myself. So that's a dream I'd love to fulfill. And I'm always practicing the guitar here and there. And I'd love to have the focus to really sit down and say, okay, I'm going to do this. And I did christen 2014 as the year of rock, so it's not over yet.
Oh, there you well. So there's plenty of time yet.
Yeah, there's lots happening. Okay. And also, well, but I did accept into a PhD program.
Excellent.
Yeah, I did at Queen's in the fall. So it's a PhD program in cultural studies. So my focus will be on popular music studies. So I'm very invigorated from the conference that I attended in Montpellier, and then also just the other pop music research I've done. It kind of came together. It's like, okay, yeah, I want to follow this. And it's such an interesting area of study. I was just thinking about it. It's really only 100 years old, give or take a few years. You have the birth of popular music with ragtime in, what was it, like late 1800s, 1900s. So it's kind of a new area of study as opposed to, say, the study of history or philosophy. Or so it's fun to be involved in something like that that's still trying to find its way or find its footing. It's not really a discipline that's established in other traditions. So yeah, I would like to follow it. I feel like I have something to say about certain artists. So
I've never known you to have something to say. Well, Marley, I thank you so much for being here. I've always enjoyed our conversations.
Thank you. I've always enjoyed them as well, and I've enjoyed the show, and thank you so much.
And we'll look forward to your show, which is back on the air, and see what you do this summer, and we'll see where we go from there.
Thank you so much.
And that was Brock instructor Marley Centoir, fresh back from attending a conference on love and rock music in France, and then traveling to Timmins, Ontario, upon her return last month. Never a dull moment in Marley's life, of course, who can be heard with her own show, The Way Out, airing at 1 p.m. following the replay of Inquisitive Minds Saturday afternoons here on CFBU-FM. Over the past several months on Inquisitive Minds, we've covered a lot of ground, discussing a wide array of topics ranging from cancer research to hockey to, as I mentioned a little while ago, the Beatles. It is a wonderful experience conducting these interviews, as I tell people I, and by extension you, get a different lecture 3 times each hour. And in the process, we all learn so much. I thought about this on the weekend and the myriad of conversations we've had on Inquisitive Minds, at this point numbering almost 100 such conversations. Back in the fall, I put together a compilation of excerpts from one of my favorite interviews done up until that point. So many of them, in fact, in order to help promote inquisitive minds. And I thought it would be fun to close the show today with that montage of conversations that so clearly illustrates the wealth and breadth of interview topics covered on the show so far. See how many of these you remember, beginning with Fiona Hunter and those amorous mosquitoes.
Aphid honeydew. Okay, so the female mosquitoes are the ones who are getting the blood meal. The first thought that came through my mind is, outside of procreating, what are the guys doing? What are the male mosquitoes doing in all this?
You have hit the nail on the head right there. Males have no real function other than to mate with the females and then die.
That's it?
Yes, that's it. And a female only needs to mate once. She can store the sperm from a single mating and use that for the rest of her life. So males are really expendable. They have to have enough energy to find a female to mate with, and then if they can mate with several females, that's good for them, but otherwise, they're done.
Don't even have to go out and get a job and support the family. It's amazing. So before then, you would have to walk, just to give people an idea of how vital this link would be. Mm-hmm. Before that road went in, they would have to trek through the countryside, essentially, 40 or so kilometers just to get to the first road.
Yes.
That's how isolated this village was.
Yes, that's certainly how inaccessible it was. And it's worth emphasizing that this is perhaps the most rugged mountain environment in the world. This was a very difficult walk. Lots of altitude increases and decreases, often walking along a trail that was only 2 or 3 feet wide with sort of cliffs below and mountain slopes above, walking across unstable slopes. So yes, it was not just a fairly long walk, but also a difficult walk, and a walk that pack animals couldn't manage because of the terrain and so on.
And in your early days going over there yourself, you would have had to make that trek because the road would not have been constructed.
Yes, I've walked it, I think I calculated 16 or 18 times.
When we say a road, in North America, we hear of road construction, and we take it for granted. We've got roads going in all the time. What kind of a road, in a situation like this, are we talking about?
It's actually a pretty good road compared to a lot of roads in the area. It's a gravel road. It's wide enough for one Jeep, if people slow down a lot and really squeeze over to the edges, two Jeeps can pass each other in certain places.
I'm going to be honest with you. A history major is not a sexy title.
No, it's not.
I suspect there may be a little bit of a stigma attached to this. History. It's not a sexy subject. How do you guys get around that? How do you work with that?
It's a lot of explaining. telling people that, you go into your somewhere social and you tell someone, oh yeah, I'm at Brock and I'm a history major.
Uh-oh.
And people say, oh, there's no jobs out there for teachers. And then that's when me and John kind of give each other a look, like, all right, take a deep breath. And we tell them, you know what, you don't just have to be a teacher. And like we said before, there's so many different things that you could possibly do with the history majors. One of our main goals, and we posted this on our Facebook page, is to change the social stigma about that. So to change exactly what you said, that it's not boring. And you don't have to be a teacher or a historian or just someone within that field.
I was down in Stratford this summer, and I watched a play by John Murrow called Taking Shakespeare. In the play, Martha Henry plays a university professor who is in the twilight of her career, as it were. And she is sent the son of the Dean of Humanities, who is not into Shakespeare, and his mother figures, I'm going to send her to this teacher to tutor him in the play Othello. If anybody can do it, she can. But the teacher, they don't hit it off right away. And one of the things the teacher says, because she's obviously totally frustrated with her educational career at this point in time, she says, the Dean of Humanities is just unhappy with me because I haven't published anything in years. What's the pressure on you as someone at a university to keep publishing? Do you have to, or is it a case of you want to?
You know, that's a great question, and it's an important question, because the hallmark of an academic, of a professor, is that you get your work out there for the masses to read, be they academics or students or whatnot. Each institution is different, but in order to get tenured at a university, you have to have a certain amount of publications. It's after tenure, which is quite interesting, which I think your question is very important, because some professors after tenure don't write anything. They don't feel the pressure to do it, and it's up to the university to enforce whatever rules they have in place, and some of them do and some of them don't.
We're talking with Michael Riepmeester and Christopher Folderson, two of the three editors of The World of Niagara Wine from Wilfrid Laurier University Press. I wanted to talk about the culture of resentment that some parts of Niagara may feel towards the wine industry. It might suggest that not everyone is thrilled with the success of the wine industry here.
You're right. We, Russell Johnson and I, have done research on that, where we've looked at the Grape and Wine Parade and the Grape and Wine Festival, and there is a fair bit of resentment, particularly over the upscale movement of the parade and what many people feel to be the less local feel, the less vernacular feel of the parade and the festival. That, you know, it's not for, and we had people tell us, it's not for us anymore. It's for out-of-town, snooty wine people. And that's a quotation.
We're talking with David Sharon, head of the Special Collections and Archives at Brock, about the War of 1812 exhibit that opened earlier this month at the St. Catharines Museum. Beyond the local level, the war allowed us nationally, as well as locally, to sort of come of age. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. It gave us something to rally around. At the time, a lot of the people who settled in this area were former Americans, and the business ties were very well linked to America, and that's why the Americans thought it would be a matter of marching across the border and taking over Canada. But it was really a wonderful thing that the inhabitants of Upper Canada saw themselves as British subjects and wanted to be their own nation, or young nation at the time. And so they came together and defended themselves, and that became a rallying point years and years later. We wouldn't be celebrating it 200 years later if it wasn't something we've been proud of for the last 200 years.
Now, the story of her walk has had a lot of, shall we say, myths attached to it over the years.
Myths are a very accurate description, yes. Outright fabrications,
exactly.
In some cases, yes.
One of which was the infamous or famous cow.
Yes. Yeah.
Was there a cow involved?
No, there wasn't. There is now in everyone's popular recollections, even sort of as the ironic little laugh that one always has about the Laura Secord story. There wasn't a cow. The jokes persist, though. And in fact, we have gone as far as to contemplate a logo that included a cow with a circle and a red line through it, just to sort of reinforce the fact that there wasn't one. But that is also sort of part of the colorful stories associated with the Secord legacy. The fact that people were moved to elaborate on what was already a pretty fantastic story, and how some of those inaccuracies are still plaguing us today.
So how much of the inaccuracies can be attributed to Laura Secord herself, and others attributed to people who just wanted to embellish the story for their own purposes?
I think primarily the latter. Laura Secord was not terribly good at transcribing the events of her walk. She had a number of situations where, in aid of others, Fitzgibbon, for example, she provided some insights, and Fitzgibbon in turn provided her with testimony as to the role of her walk and the importance in the Battle of Beaver Dams and the outcome of that particular skirmish.
Talking about the Ron Ford story now, let's start with the examples of his bullying tactics that have been in the news. Being so well covered in the news for weeks now, we get to see firsthand some of the tactics a bully may use, be it the mayor being accused of or whomever. It wasn't pretty, but it was all out there for us to see.
Yes, and it's unfortunate that we have had an opportunity to see a person displaying bullying behavior. So once again, bullying behaviors, anytime you're seeking to intimidate a person, publicly humiliating a person, teasing a person, devaluing a person, anytime those behaviors occur, the person is indeed displaying bullying behaviors. And I think it's a classic example of how bullies interact. It's also a classic example of what happens to a bully when the individual begins to lose control. The individual begins to lose power. People begin to stand up to that individual. hold that person accountable. And sometimes if you have been a bully, and I'm not saying that Rob Ford has always been a bully, but let's say, for example, he was a bully as a child and no one corrected his behavior. So he's grown up to believe that this behavior is acceptable, and the bully has been able to get his way throughout his lifetime. Now he's in a situation where there's some pushback. People are not tolerating the behavior. And so the bully, once again, remember I said my belief is that a bully is someone who's very insecure. So what happens with an insecure person? They begin to become very defensive because now they're protecting themselves because they don't want the world to see their insecurities, their shortcomings. And so as I have been watching this scenario play out, I see a person who is self-destructing because perhaps he doesn't have the proper techniques in place to address the challenges that he's now facing.
Staying up all night, spoken like a true student. That will change, I can guarantee you. Here's a fun question for you as we wrap things up. You talked about your music being, I guess in a way, a release for you. What else would you do that when you close your books, you shut down the computer, and you say, I've had enough of this for this morning, because by then it's probably about 4 or 5 in the morning. What brings you pleasure beyond the music and beyond the university life?
Talking to my friends, hanging out with my friends, going out to grab a drink once in a while. Yeah, just try and stay social and stay connected to people and see what's going on in other people's lives.
And there we heard a montage of some of the interviews conducted on Inquisitive Minds over the past several months, ranging from professors to graduate students, all providing valuable information in an accessible, engaging manner here on the show. Hope you enjoyed that look back. And remember, you can always access all the interviews done on the show by going to the archive page of the website at www.cfbu.ca. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next time, always remember to have an inquisitive mind.